Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I'm your host, Massimo Piliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what's our topic today?
Massimo, tonight we are happy to be joined by Stephen Novella, the host of a little podcast that some of you may have heard of called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, as well as the author of the Neurologica blog and co-editor of the Science-Based Medicine blog. And in his free time, he's also an academic clinical neurologist at the Yale University School of Medicine. Steve, great to have you on the show.
Nice to be here, guys. Thanks for having me.
I didn't know you had any free time, but...
Yeah, right.
Just a little hobby called academic clinical neurology, right. That's all.
All right, Steve. We're probably going to be all over the place with you tonight because there's so many interesting things to talk about. But I wanted to start with a little bit of controversy of which you are aware. Recently, The Atlantic, in November of this year, published an article by David Friedman entitled Lies, Damn Lies, and Medical Science. And in this article, there are some serious things that emerge from recent meta studies of the efficacy of medical research. You want to give us the background and tell us what you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, this is not news to anyone, at least not anyone familiar with science-based medicine or the science of medicine. Essentially, the article focuses on the work of researcher John Ioannidis, or Ioannidis, I think you pronounce his name. And he is a researcher who studies the research itself, basically looking at the patterns in the literature and how reliable are studies and the kinds of problems that can occur with medical research. And he's published some seminal papers over the years showing, for example, that if you look at definitive studies that where we could be pretty sure that we know what the answer is, then you look back over the previous 20 years, that in fact most of the previous studies that were published on that question came up with the wrong answer. So this is often presented as the notion that, you know, most published research is wrong, which is a bit misleading. But essentially the idea here is that there's a lot of inherent systematic problems with research. There's just so many things that can go wrong, and often it does. So that raises the bigger question is, well, how reliable is anything that we do in medicine anyway? How science-based can it be? So, you know, again, what's interesting is that, you know, Friedman, the author of this article, and, you know, many people who pick up on this theme, point out all of the things that we point out, for example, on the Science-Based Medicine blog about all of the pitfalls and all of the complexity and difficulty with medical research. But you can put two different spins on this story. On the one hand, you could say, here are all of the, you know, the problems with medical research, and this is the way around them, or to way to look out for them, or to fix them, if you will. Or you could say, look at all the problems with medical research. It's broken and it doesn't work.
Right. Now, that I think that's very fair. However, I was honestly a little bit surprised about some of the numbers. And I wonder if you think that the numbers are, in fact, at least approximately correct. For instance, you know, the article mentions something like 80% of non-randomized studies turn out to have something wrong with them, 25% of randomized trials, and 10% of large randomized trials. Now, those are fairly astounding numbers, especially the 80%. Do you think that those are actually accurate numbers, at least in the ballpark?
I think they're in the ballpark. But again, see what he's saying there is that the less controlled the study, the more unreliable the results. Like, yeah, we know that.
Right,
you know?
That's not surprising. Right.
Yeah, when you get up to the gold standard of randomized, double-blind, you know, placebo-controlled trials, he's saying that 10% of those have serious problems. Well, that means that 90% are pretty good. That's actually better than I would have thought, actually.
But do you have any sense of how frequently the 80% are used? I mean, are researchers and doctors when they're prescribing things and treating patients, are they drawing from that large group of studies that are wrong?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're drawing from that research all the time. And again, that is what the evidence-based medicine movement basically is about, which is let's actually systematically and rigorously assess what the evidence base is for all the things that physicians do. And, you know, in a standardized, systematic way, characterize that or quantify that so that it, rather than sort of shooting from the hip, right, where you know, are using your judgment or your best guess or some vague familiarity with the research, or you're just pulling from whatever studies you happen to see most recently, you know, rather than relying upon that sort of slipshod method of deciding what is a good thing to do in medicine, let's take a systematic approach and see what the actual evidence base is and quantify it. And in, you know, with science-based medicine, we go a little bit beyond that. We agree with pretty much everything that evidence-based medicine does, but we want to reintroduce the notion of prior plausibility. You know, all that basic science research, not chuck that out and pretend like it doesn't exist. So it's if you don't do that, then you basically are overwhelmed with bias. There's so many ways that bias can creep into the way you look at data. And again, you know, the medical community has applauded Unitas for pointing all these things out in a very rigorous way. So I think that says a lot. I mean, even the author, you know, Friedman acknowledges in the article that he's trying to put this very sensationalistic spin on it all. But the fact is, Unitas's work is accepted. It's applauded. We know that we need to look very critically at the literature, at the way research is done, at all the different ways biases can creep into the end results. And because by understanding that better, we get better at finding the actual truth, which is what we're after at the end of the day.
So you introduced the distinction there between, of course, evidence-based and science-based medicine. The way you just put it, it sounded to me like you were introducing some sort of Bayesian framework in science-based medicine.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Is that right?
It could be very Bayesian, yeah.
So you're saying, is that the major difference between the two approaches, or would you characterize it also otherwise?
No, I think that's it. I mean, it's basically what I think happened is, you know, at the dawn of the evidence-based, you know, movement, the big notion was that physicians were relying too heavily on plausibility. They were essentially using treatments because they made sense. Right. But that's not always a sufficient guide to what works. There are things that make sense that which turn out not to be true. The evidence doesn't support them. So I think they had the intention of leveling the playing field, if you will. You know, they call it evidence-based medicine because they want to base the treatment on what the evidence shows and not give a treatment an unfair advantage, if you will, just because it makes sense. But what they unwittingly did was they leveled the playing field for those therapies which are highly implausible, right? So plausibility doesn't count, but neither does implausibility. And when you apply an evidence-based, you know, scheme to treatments that have a plausibility of zero, it kind of breaks down.
Can you give an example of a treatment that has a really low plausibility but that was still implemented? And why would it be implemented if it had such a low probability? Because we got results supporting it?
Well, this comes up mainly in the context of like so-called alternative medicine, like homeopathy, for example. So you can read a Cochrane evidence-based review of the literature on homeopathy for a specific indication. Now, when you do that, what you'll find is that the evidence is actually negative pretty much for everything, that for homeopathy doesn't work for anything. But it's easy to look at a very specific question and to say, oh, there's some interesting signal here. The evidence doesn't quite show that it works, but it deserves further research, and maybe, you know, there's weak evidence that can support incorporating this into practice. But actually, that ignores all of the things that Unitas talks about. What's interesting is that I quote his research saying, well, but if you have to consider that if you're basically doing research on a treatment that, let's say, hypothetically, we know the treatment has zero physiological effect, it doesn't work. what would you expect the literature to look like? That's a very important question, right. And I often ask people that. What do you think the literature would look like if we studied a treatment that we know absolutely doesn't work? And sometimes I have, you know, proponents of alternative medicine have told me, well, it should be pretty much 50-50. It should be like a bell curve, you know, hovering around a null effect or a zero effect. But that's actually not what we see. And Unitas' work shows us that's not what we would expect to see. We would expect to see a huge bias towards the positive, partly because of publication bias, because of researcher bias, just because of all the ways in which you can bias the research by the types of questions that you ask, the outcomes that you look at, the statistics that you do. So what we actually expect to see, even for a completely inactive treatment, is this shift of bias to the right, to the positive. However, we also see that the better controlled and designed the studies, the smaller the effect size, and that the effect size diminishes to zero for the best designed studies. That's exactly what we see for homeopathy. But if you take an evidence-based scheme, you see this residue of positive studies that sometimes makes them portray it in a wishy-washy or sometimes even weakly positive light. Whereas the science-based approach would say, well, hang on, let's back up. Let's take a look at, first of all, everything we know about the biases in the literature, and second of all, the prior plausibility of homeopathy, which approaches zero. If you combine those two things together, we see, well, this is a null effect. This is exactly what we expect to see for a treatment that does not work. In science-based medicine, we advocate more of a Bayesian analysis, which basically says you have a prior probability, and then you have a new piece of evidence, and then you could do a calculation to say, well, how does that alter the prior probability to that, so that you get a post-probability? What's the probability after this new bit of information? Rather than saying, which evidence-based medicine does, is that we assume absolute neutrality prior to looking at the evidence, in this case, the clinical evidence. Saying that the probability essentially is neutral, just as likely to be true as not to be true.
That seems like a big assumption in and of itself, though.
It is.
Well, it's essentially an assumption of flat priors, right?
Exactly. It assumes a completely flat or a neutral prior probability. Essentially, I think the reason why that was done was because they didn't want to give an unfair advantage to treatments just because they made sense, right? They didn't want physicians using a treatment just simply because it made some kind of a sense. So they wanted to level the playing field. But when they did that, trying to take away the advantage of plausible treatments, they also took away the disadvantage of extremely implausible treatments. So, I think that's a problem. So if you look at something like homeopathy, for example, which has a prior probability that approaches zero, and then you look at the...
You think?
Look at the evidence. Yeah. I mean, it violates some basic laws of physics and chemistry and things like that.
That's pretty bad.
And then you look at the clinical evidence. If a strictly evidence-based approach would say, well, okay, if we assume neutrality going in, then we see this sort of weakly positive result in the clinical data, then nothing is proven. There's not really good class one evidence. We can't say that there's any indication for a homeopathic treatment that's proven. But for some things, you get this residue of weakly positive of results. So therefore, maybe there's something there and it deserves further research. That's usually how they conclude. But if you take more of a science-based approach, you say, well, based on the notion, first of all, this is highly implausible up front, then you add the clinical data. It actually doesn't change the prior plausibility very much, the prior probability. You end up with a post-data probability that still is almost zero, so it hasn't really affected it very much. But also you see another pattern in the research with treatments that have a null effect, and that is the better the design the study, the more like the smaller the effect size, and until the best studies have essentially a flat or a zero effect size. So when you see that pattern coupled with a low prior probability because of just highly implausible claim, and you have this weakly positive bias or residue in the published data, that's consistent with a null effect or a treatment that has no actual clinical effect. And where Unitas' work comes in is he explains why we see this positive bias in the published literature. because of all the many, many things that, that a researcher can do to create this positive bias in the research by the kind of variables that are selected, the outcome measures, how they're measured, how the patients are selected, how they're randomized. There's all different ways to subtly, whether consciously or unconsciously, affect the outcome of research. And so the implication is that, for example, pharmaceutical companies may be quite deliberately doing this in order to, you know, portray their drugs in as positive light as possible. But I think there's also just a lot of very honest researchers who are doing it very unconsciously. It's just, it's really hard to systematically eliminate every possible source of bias in something as messy and complicated as clinical research. That's why, in fact, we say we have to consider all the research, including the basic science research. You'd like to see that a treatment is plausible, that it makes sense, that we have a mechanism, that it works when you look at observational studies in the real world, that it has efficacy when you look at really rigorously controlled trials, you know, experimental trials. You'd like to see that it all hangs together.
But Steve, this reminds me of a problem that we encounter pretty often in ecology and evolutionary biology, and this has to do actually with the whole concept of meta-analysis.
Yeah.
Some people are very much in favor of doing meta-analysis on the grounds, of course, that way, so you distill the signal, if there is any, of a large number of studies, and sort of smoothing over the inequalities between studies, the different conditions, and so on and so forth. But I often heard also the criticism going the other way around and saying, essentially, in fact, you dilute the signal because you put together a bunch of studies that are really not that reliable, the sample size are too small. And an example that I have in mind came out a few years ago, doing a meta-analytical review of studies on natural selection, which, as you know, it's a fundamental concept in evolutionary biology. Well, it turns out that if you actually just simply look at a simple meta-analysis of hundreds and hundreds of studies in experimental studies or empirical studies of natural selection, turns out that there is no such thing as natural selection because the average selection coefficient is very close to zero. Mm-hmm. The explanation for that is that the overwhelming majority of studies on natural selection are actually poorly done. Right. Mostly, they're not repeated in time or space, and they have small sample sizes, which means that on average, you know, the effect size essentially is close to zero, becomes undetectable. So the argument that one would make in that case is that rather than doing a meta-analysis, what you should do is to go carefully through the studies, throw out 90% of them because they're clearly methodologically flawed or insufficient, and then look at what the remaining 10% or so tells you. And I wonder if this is not part of the problem that we're having here, that is, the studies that are mentioned, the conclusions that are mentioned in The Atlantic that say things like, you know, 80% of non-randomized trials are flawed or turned out wrong result. Well, is there a way that we can tell ahead of time, once the study is published, and you know what, this is really not a good standard, a good way of doing things, so let's just throw it out and not counting it at all?
Yeah, let me talk about meta-analysis first of all. There actually was a study published a few years ago looking at, again, this one of these meta questions, is how reliable are meta-analysis? It's a meta of meta-analyses, and it showed that they only predict the outcome of later definitive trials about 60% of the time.
Oh, wow. Hmm.
Which, when you think 50% is a coin flip, that's not that much better.
Right.
It's only a little bit better. So meta-analyses are actually not that reliable. Essentially, you're introducing another layer of bias, because now you have biases in terms of how you choose which studies to include in the meta-analysis and how do you choose to adjust for differences among these trials. So you're introducing more bias, which I think probably does counteract the effect of adding more, you know, data points, right?
Right.
So they're very, very tricky to do well. When done well, I do think they serve a role. But I agree with you that systematic reviews are better than meta-analysis. And a systematic review looks at all the published research and then looks for the pattern that you see in that research. It analyzes every individual study. It doesn't just lump the data together.
Right.
And it says, okay, so we see a bunch of crappy studies that are poorly controlled. We can ignore those. Here are the really good studies, and they're consistently showing this. But I wouldn't say that then the question comes up, what's the role then of these poor studies? Why are so many poor studies being
good
done?
Good question.
It is a good question, but you know, the thing is, there is a role for every kind of research. The problem is not, sometimes it's that, you know, that research is done poorly. It's supposed to serve a certain role and it's just not being done well. But the bigger problem in my experience is just evidence is used incorrectly. Like you can't use observational data to make efficacy conclusions because you're not controlling for variables, for example. But in this case, the part of the problem is that you're looking at what we call preliminary data, preliminary studies, and then trying to draw some kind of definitive conclusion from it or base your medical practice on it. But the role of preliminary studies is to help you design later definitive trials. So they do serve a role. You can't go right to the large definitive trial because you won't know how best to do it. You learn how to research a very specific question by doing these preliminary studies, and that's what the later definitive studies emerge out of, all of the argument about what these preliminary studies mean. The problem is, however, is basing your practice on these preliminary studies rather than saying, all right, all these tell us is how basically to do more research to find out what the real answer is. And again, what Unitas's work tells us is if you rely on that preliminary data, most of the time you're going to be wrong.
So, Steve, one of our readers on the Rationally Speaking blog brought up this question of whether there's some research that just is never going to be able to approach the standards of rigor that we would need to really be confident in it. And so he was talking about some of the studies that have been, well, observational because they can't be otherwise, like studies on the effect of various vitamins on health. And, you know, we can't take a group of people and make them take this vitamin over a long period of time and take this other group of people and have them not. And so we're left just sort of trying to find patterns in the data. And so he was sort of expressing pessimism about whether we ever could do research on these areas that would be accurate.
Yeah, so I file that under difficult but not impossible, and you have to appreciate how difficult it is. But let me give you the classic example of that kind of data. That's the data linking smoking with lung cancer, right? And he's basically taking the tobacco industry line that no one has ever done the kinds of studies that would definitively prove a cause and effect between smoking and certain kinds of lung cancer because you can't randomize people to smoke, right? You can't do that study. You can't randomize people to not get proven therapy. You know, so there are certain things that are just unethical. You can't expose them to risks, expose them to disease, or withhold care. So for that reason, we are limited to observational studies. So then what do? Well, we try to pile up as much of the inferential data as we can and see if it all triangulates to the same answer. So we could do animal studies. You can make rats smoke. Over years, you could expose them to cigarette smoke and see if they develop lung cancer. And you could look at, you could make a hypothesis if smoking causes lung cancer, then we should see a dose response curve. The longer you smoke, the higher your risk of lung cancer. If you smoke unfiltered, it should be higher than if you smoke filtered. If you quit, your risk should start to come down. If we look at it for an underlying mechanism, you know, we should see that there's got to be a carcinogen in there somewhere. So you put together the basic science, the animal data, and multiple different kinds of observational data to see if it all triangulates and lines up on the one hypothesis to explain these correlations, and that is that smoking actually causes lung cancer. And you can get to a point where you're confident enough that you can make some actual medical recommendations based upon that. And you could do the same thing with vitamin studies or with other things. The trick is not to give up early, not to look at one observational study or two observational studies and say, oh, okay, B12 prevents Alzheimer's disease. Now we know that. Rather than saying, okay, this is interesting observational data. There seems to be a signal here. There's some kind of correlation. Now let's think of all the many ways in which this correlation could exist or all the different kinds of biases that could be creeping into this observation and then look at the data frontwards and backwards and sideways and all these different ways and see if no matter how we choose to ask this question and look at the data, we still get this signal that there is some beneficial effect to taking this vitamin. You can get to the point where it's reliable enough that you could make healthcare recommendations based upon that.
So it sounds like you're actually a lot more optimistic than I've heard Unitas sound in describing his own research. I read a quote from him in which he said, I'm not sure that more than a very small percentage of medical research is ever likely to lead to major improvements in clinical outcomes and quality of life. And so what it sounds like you're saying, if I'm understanding you correctly, is that a large percentage of the research is actually barking up the wrong tree, but that it's all indirectly leading to definitive research, definitive accurate research down the road. But it's a mistake to consider those preliminary findings somehow part of the problem when they're actually part of the process. Is that accurate?
Mostly. I wouldn't say all studies are part of the process. I think there's also a lot of crappy research in there too. You know, I think sometimes people just do a bad job at the research, or academics are under a lot of pressure to publish, and I think sometimes people publish data just because they got to get, they got to get papers out there.
Sure.
Sometimes I shake my head and wonder, why did anyone bother to do this study? You know, sometimes people go backwards. You know, you'd like to see the literature progress forward, where you're learning something from the previous studies, and then you're doing research to add some kind of a new information or new angle to the data. And sometimes I see people going backwards and doing studies which are worse than ones that have already been done, and they actually don't tell us anything. And you wonder why somebody even bothered to do that kind of a study. So there's a lot of messiness. There's a lot of noise. There's a lot of crap in the research. I'm sure this is true of every discipline. But you have to sort of wade through that, pick out the good studies, look for the patterns in the research, see that it all holds together. And we have many, many things for which that's the case. We just sort of take them for granted now. And the reason why scientists and physicians were not surprised by any of this, because if you have a sophisticated and mature approach to the literature, the kind of things that we like to teach our students, for example, this is what we've been saying for years, for decades. This is not news to anybody. We know this. This is how you have to look at the whole research, the whole literature, not just pick out the studies that you want or some small subset of the studies or make the wrong kinds of inferences from the wrong kinds of data.
So, Steve, some of what you were saying actually reminds me, all these, the idea that there is a lot of studies out there, a significant portion of which is, let's say, sub-quality. For a variety of reasons, including the sociological ones you were talking about, there's the publish or perish attitude in academia. People have to get tenure and, all that sort of stuff. There's a classic article that was published in Science in 1964 by John Platt. The title of the article is Strong Inference. It's a real classic commentary about the methodologies of different sciences, particularly comparing the social sciences with the sort of chemical and physical sciences. And Platt at one point says that, people often refer to science as building the edifice of knowledge brick by brick, but they keep forgetting that the majority of these bricks just lay around in the backyard unused. And that seems like a pretty good metaphor for what is still going on today. In fact, possibly worse than the situation was in 1964, because we have a lot more people trying to get into scientific careers. The level of competition arguably has increased compared to what it was 30 or 40 years ago, and so we have a lot of other bricks out there that they're just lines on somebody's CVs, but they actually don't serve any purpose, and they sort of clutter, and make it more difficult for us to understand, to discriminate the noise from the signal.
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot more noise. There's a lot more clutter. There's more journals. There's a lot of so-called throwaway journals, that you can publish. There's a lot of online publishing now, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. I think there's some, good quality online journals. But it just means there's just this explosion of information. There's so many articles to sort through it's very, very challenging. I kind of liken it to a little bit to taking pictures. You snap a lot of pictures, and at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how many bad ones you have. The only thing that really matters is how many good ones you have, right?
Yeah, that's
you have
that's a good
10
metaphor.
Good pictures from your vacation. That's what matters. It doesn't matter if you took a million bad ones. You can just delete them.
Especially if you have a digital camera. That's very easy to do.
Exactly. With medicine, it's not a perfect analogy because it does matter that you get the good data at the end of the day, and you can ignore the bad data. But there are limited resources out there for doing studies,
right,
and there's a certain ethics involved in subjecting people. So I do think that we probably should raise the bar a little bit for the kind of research that people are doing, and maybe remove a little bit of the noise and clutter, and not do so many preliminary studies. I think we should maybe move a little bit more efficiently to the definitive trials.
So, Steve, a little earlier you were talking about the problem of publication bias as being a major contributing factor to the problem that Unitas has been publicizing. It essentially just that if you do enough studies testing for some effect, then just by chance, some of them are going to find a significant effect. And those are the studies that the journals are going to want to publish. So,
right.
So this does seem like a big problem. And what I wanted to ask you about was a recent solution that my understanding is has been tried for clinical trials, at least, that now, at least in the U.S., there's a requirement that you have to register all your clinical trials at clinicaltrials.gov, so that essentially
yes.
if you have 20 studies that search for an effect and only two found one, then it's no longer the case that you just see those two published and you have no idea what the larger pool looks like. But you can actually go to the clinicaltrials.gov and see what percentage these positive results represent out of the entirety. So what is the
absolutely.
Status of that? Is that working? Is this going to solve our problems?
Well, it is a huge step in the right direction for clinical trials. And part of this was motivated by the fact that pharmaceutical companies are not just engaging in well-meaning publication bias. They're actually cherry-picking. I mean, there are cases where they'll do five studies and then publish the two that had a positive outcome and bury the three that had a negative outcome.
Right.
But if you look at all of the trials, it's actually the net outcome is zero or no effect. So, cherry picking is a serious problem. It's basically mm-hmm. cheating. You're looking at a subset of the data. And as long as you divide that data among more than one trial, you can just ignore those trials that you don't have the results that you like. I think that what we're moving towards, which is we absolutely need, is essentially transparency. It's rigorous transparency by registering every trial, essentially saying along with the privilege of doing research on human beings comes the responsibility to make that data available to researchers and academics, and you can't hide it after the fact. You don't own that data. The public owns that data because you were given the privilege of doing research on human beings. Therefore, we can get much more reliable and thorough results, because that's what's necessary in order for science to work. I don't know that it will solve all the problems, but I think it's a necessity. It's definitely a requirement for the results to be reliable.
Now, speaking of big pharma, this reminds me of a paper that came out maybe within the last couple of years, possibly even more recently than this, which was comparing several papers addressing the efficacy of the same kind of drugs and then dividing the papers into two groups depending on the funding source, whether the funding was provided by the pharmaceutical industry or private sector, and whether it was provided by a federal agency, for instance. And perhaps not surprisingly, they did detect, again, sort of what I might call some kind of intelligent design there in operation,
right.
Which was that the studies funded by the pharmaceutical industry were several times more likely to find significant results, positive results, but of the drugs, that compared to those funded by the federal government. Now, there was no implication there that there was actual cheating, at least not in the article that I'm referring to. The idea was that, if you know where your money's coming from, there's all sorts of, more or less subconscious biases that you can introduce into your own research, your own conclusions, the way you present the data, and so on and so forth. So there's no need to necessarily actually invoke conscious fraud by the researchers involved. Now, that does, however, raise the question of the funding sources for this research. Is there a general way to approach this kind of problem, or we're just stuck with it because of the nature of medical research?
Well, let me give you two different answers there. First,
sure.
I think that while there is unconscious, just experimenter bias that creeps in, I think there's also some not-so-unconscious bias that creeps in with pharmaceutical research, or I would say industry research, the supplement industry. Every industry does this. If you have a vested interest in the outcome, it's hard not for that not to creep in to the effects. And it's not just this sort of vague bias that we can't quantify. Sometimes there are very specific choices that are made that we could say, that choice was rigging the game in favor of a positive outcome. By looking at the kinds of outcomes you choose to measure, how you choose to randomize, or the inclusion or exclusionary criteria, basically the people you choose to do the research on. You know, certainly pharmaceutical companies design studies to give their drugs the best chance of having a good outcome. I think that probably explains most of that bias towards a better chance of having a good outcome. They're essentially looking where the light is good, or you know, doing the studies that are more likely to be positive, even when done rigorously well. So I was going to make another point. Remind me what the question was. This latter part of your question.
The question was whether there was a general, kind of approach or solution that we could pursue about these inherent bias that is generated by the funding. So you said that you had two different answers to it.
Yeah. So the other part of that was that because we could identify specific behaviors, then that opens the door to fixing them, right? To doing things that will mitigate them. And I guess the other point I was going to make was, what do we do about the funding, I think you were asking? You know, yes. Are we stuck with a system in which the industry funds a lot of studies? Well, that's a big question. You know, we have a capitalistic system. We rely upon the pharmaceutical industry, for example, to spend billions of dollars on research. We just don't have an infrastructure that can replace that funding. So
unless we are stuck.
Radically change the structure of our society, we're going to need to deal with industry-funded research. I don't think it's a fatal problem, though. I'm not nihilistic about it. I think it can work. We just need, because you know, we're actually pretty smart and pretty good at figuring out all the ways to manipulate data and bias trials. You know, we can make them better. And at the end of the day, there is a lot of good research that eventually gets done. I think it's hard. It's actually pretty hard to create the never-ending illusion of a benefit where one doesn't actually exist. Eventually, you know, that they come home to roost. And in other words, eventually, if something doesn't work, we'll see that in the literature. We'll see that in the research.
Now, let me go back for a second to a sentence from the Atlantic magazine, and that's simply because it made me think about what I do every morning. And I'm going to give you the example of, you know, I think of myself as a reasonably informed person about science, and I go to my doctor and talk to my doctor to a good degree about whether there is any problem or not. And then I read this thing that says, and I quote, "We consume thousands of nutrients that act together as a sort of network, and changing intake of just one of them is bound to cause ripples throughout the network that are far too complex for these studies to detect and that may be as likely to harm you as to help you." That's the unquote. Now, here's my problem. So I understand, as a biologist, that what he's saying is correct. I mean, there is, in fact, a lot of, you know, metabolism is a very complex network, and it's certainly the case that you can't just intervene in one surgical place and solve a problem. On the other mm-hmm. hand, that raises a very practical question for me. You know, so my doctor told me a few months ago that I have a slight vitamin D3 deficiency, so I'll be taking pills in the morning for that. And I go to my cardiologist, and my cardiologist says, you know, for your age, your heart is in pretty good condition, your artery is in pretty good condition. On the other hand, because of family histories, it might not be a bad idea to start taking some, low-dose aspirin and that sort of stuff. Now, mm-hmm. then you read, as an informed person who talked to your doctor, you read that kind of thing in the paper, and then you say, well, should I really bother taking this stuff in the morning, spending money, depending on how many supplements you do? Or should I just say, you know what, as far as I'm concerned, as long as I just try a reasonable diet and a little bit of exercise and nothing really major happens, don't bother. What would your take as a practical matter be once you read this kind of article?
It's part of the question is, where do you set the threshold, you know, for saying that, all right, there's enough evidence here to make a decision based upon that. But partly, it's worth pointing out that not doing something is a decision too, and there really isn't. It isn't always necessary to make that the default decision. Although we do, say, first do no harm, right? We want to make sure we're not at least harming somebody or doing something that's going to make things worse.
Right.
So there is a little bit of a bias towards the default of not doing something, but. When you're talking about preventive measures, et cetera, not doing something is a decision. It is a choice. So, for example, with aspirin, that's a really good question. And there are situations in which we have really good data that taking a gentle blood thinner like a certain dose of aspirin on a daily basis reduces the risks of heart attacks and strokes. And then there's a population for which the data is in the gray zone where it may be beneficial, but there's also this increase in, you know, stomach problems and bleeding, and we're not exactly sure where the lines cross, and you may be close to that line. You know, maybe just as likely to give yourself an ulcer as prevent a stroke or a heart attack.
Great, and then you just made my life more complicated.
Yeah, and then there's people who clearly shouldn't be taking it.
Right,
you know,
right.
So there's always going to be that gray zone. And unless you are steeped in the literature where you could make a very well-informed decision, you basically have to rely upon an expert to make that decision for you or to give you at least give you good advice. And you go, like with anything, what's the consensus of expert opinion? You know, has a panel of disinterested scientists looked at this data and come up with recommendations? And is your physician following those recommendations? Or again, are they shooting from the hip? You know, are they saying things like, well, in my experience, or are they saying, well, the Academy of Physicians looked at this data and these are the official recommendations, so that's what we're following. You know, it turns out that when you follow official recommendations that are rigorously evidence-based and reviewed by expert panels, the outcomes actually are better than if you just go based upon your gut or what your sense of the research is. I wish there were some algorithm or easy answer to all this, but there isn't. It's complicated, and there's no substitute for. Going through a lot of complicated data and making a nuanced assessment.
Thanks for giving me something else to think about tomorrow morning after breakfast.
Okay, Steve, before you give Massimo even more complications to his daily routine, I'm going to cut you off now, and we are going to move along to the Rationally Speaking picks.
Welcome back. As usual, we finish our episode with a pick or two of books, websites, movies, or anything else that might be interesting to our listeners. When we have guests, we ask them to do the honors. So, Steve, what is your pick this time?
Okay, well, I was given very short notice for this, so I'm just going to go with something that I've seen very recently. There's a new series on AMC called The Walking Dead. Have you guys heard about this?
Oh, no. That sounds interesting.
Now, you know, I'm a big fan of the zombie genre.
Okay.
And what pleased me about, I saw that the first episode of this, what's good about this show is that it's not like a cartoony approach to the whole like zombie apocalypse question. They're actually trying to have good writing and good character development. It's just really good storytelling that just happens to be taking place in a world where there's been a zombie apocalypse. So I'm very actually excited after seeing the first episode. I love well-written science fiction because there's so much crappy science fiction out there. You know, I think a lot of shows will rely upon special effects or rely upon, you know, the sort of science fiction cliches. When you get that magical combination of, you know, something that's taking place within a genre that you like zombies or sci-fi, but also it's just great storytelling and great fiction, then you have something really worthwhile. Like for example, Battlestar Galactica right up until the last episode.
Right.
So, Steve, I'm curious about your take on the science, on specifically the epidemiology of the idea of a zombie pandemic. So what I've heard in some places is that the mechanics of a zombie epidemic wouldn't actually work well, that the epidemic would quickly burn itself up. Is this the sort of thing that could, in theory, actually happen?
Well, you know that an epidemiologist wrote a paper about this, looking at a zombie outbreak as a model infectious disease.
Right.
And he basically showed that it could work, and it wouldn't take too long for the world to be overrun with zombies, actually. Yeah, so it depends on the variables, right? There's lots of variables you have to manipulate. In terms of, you know, how you conceive the zombies functioning. Is it, first of all, is it an infection? It's not always an infection. If it is, how is it passed from one person to the next? Is it airborne? Does it have to be a bite? Does there need to be saliva? Could it be any bit of a zombie? Is surface contact enough, or do you need an open wound? The harder it is to get infected, then the harder it will, the slower it will spread.
Right.
You could also look at the incubation period. You know, how long does somebody harbor the zombie infection before they manifest signs?
Good question.
The longer the incubation period, the longer you'll again, the farther you'll pass it around before it gets noticed. That's why it was an interesting epidemiological paper, because all the same variables are there that are there for a real infection, and you know, it was sort of a whimsical way of modeling a hypothetical outbreak or pandemic, just making it a zombie infection versus something else. All of the same rules though apply.
Well, that wasn't quite as reassuring as I'd hoped, but but interesting at least.
Yep.
So unfortunately, we're now all out of time, but it was such a pleasure having you on the show, Steve.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
It was so much fun. And so we are going to wrap up now, but I just wanted to, again, remind all of our listeners that the Rationally Speaking podcast is brought to you by the New York City Skeptics, and we encourage you to go to the website, nycskeptics.org, and check out all of our interesting material there on upcoming events and lectures and our upcoming conference, the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, and think about becoming a member. So join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.